You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 109. Every secret of a writer's soul, every experience of his life, every quality of his mind is written large in his works. Virginia Woolf.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Well, guys, today is part three of the James Hart interview series, and today's guest is going to be Bo Burnham, who is the writer of the critically and box office hit Eighth Grade. Now, Eighth Grade came out in 2018, released by A24, and was produced by Scott Rudin. And it was kind of a runaway hit when it came out. And James and Bo sit down to discuss how he broke down his own anxieties and issues that he had himself, and he put those into his script that made it come alive, and about what it was like to be premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, what the bidding war was like to get bought by A24, which is essentially the Sundance of independent film distribution. And James also helps break down the emotional journey of all the characters and structure of Eighth Grade. So without any further ado, please enjoy this rare conversation between James V. Hart and Bo Burnham.
Hello, everybody.
I watched the film again last night and today. And I was going to make some joke and comment about it being autobiographical, but it is, according to some of the reading. So could you talk a little bit about where this came from you personally?
Yeah, I mean, truthfully, I was at the time in my life, I was doing stand-up. I was a stand-up comedian for 10 years that then sort of secretly had a passion for screenwriting the entire time. And sort of came to the end of the road of doing stand-up because I was having panic attacks on stage and just felt like I couldn't perform any longer. And I would try to talk about my anxiety on stage, about my own personal experience with my anxiety, which was tied up with being on stage, presenting myself, having an audience, performing. And then the only people that seemed to really understand it were like 14-year-old girls that would come up to me after the show and go like, because I assumed that only like 27-year-old male comedians would understand what I was going through. But the men my age didn't understand it, but the young women would come up to me and say, that's exactly how I live. And I was going, what are you talking about? And I realized that the sort of specific pressures that made me anxious, which were tied to sort of performance and how I was seen, had been sort of democratized and given to an entire generation. So I sort of felt like, okay, we've told our story with my circumstance. Now let's tell our story with your circumstance. So truthfully, it was autobiographical, but it took a connection with people like Kayla to show me just how similar I was to them. It was people like Kayla seeing themselves in me before I sort of saw myself in her.
So, bad question, but what were the 14-year-old girls doing in a comedy club?
It was in theaters, and it's a little bit more of a theater show. So it's like a musical theater show that's a little more akin to young people than I didn't feel comfortable in comedy clubs, like the Brick Walls and the Chicken Fingers and the, I don't know. I never vibed with it. But I mean, that's sort of the maybe, I mean, that explanation for the inspiration is sort of like the thing I figured out after the fact. You know, I wasn't consciously thinking that, but really going into it, it was just, I felt like I was from the internet. I grew up on the internet, and in some way I'm sort of the oldest person that's grown up on the internet. And I just felt like it wasn't being portrayed correctly. I felt like kids weren't being portrayed correctly. And I felt like it was a whole generation that was being talked about culturally as self-obsessed, when I thought they're actually anxious and self-conscious. So,
yeah. Can you recall, you were a stand-up comedian, you still have a career, you're out there with crowds, but can you recall the moment or the circumstances on which you decided to sit down and you were going to write the screenplay and you were going to direct it, what that incubation process was for you?
Yeah. I mean, I had been writing sort of secretly and just been sort of very tired of myself as a subject. So, but I had written another script, earlier. There was a high school script that I had tried to get made, that was way big, inherently sort of a bigger budget. And I had tried to direct it myself, and it like didn't work at all. And hold on, let me, I'll do that answer again, because our dog's coming back into the house. All right.
We might have lightning. We're dogs.
I'll take the answer again.
Please, we're dog people.
Good. I'm settled.
Take two.
Yeah, okay, the decision to decide to write directed. Yeah. So I had written another script previously. Oh my God.
Please. Those are great.
This is life. I had written another script previously that was a high school script that was a sort of a bigger budget movie. It was maybe probably in the studio space. And I had shot the opening scene of it to try to direct it. And I was sort of shot down. But I think for the right reasons, I shouldn't have directed that script. And I didn't really write it with the thought that I would direct it. But with this one, I definitely sat down specifically going, I want to write something that I think plays to what I think my strengths might be as a writer, as a director, which I just guessed were, I thought were, I feel like I can write kids the way they talk, and I feel like I can get them to act in the way they actually are and not have it be too overprocessed, and you know, hopefully just make something natural. Listic.
Did anybody try to talk you out of writing it yourself? Or were you?
No, I never really told anyone to have them talk me out of it, you know? And the truth was, the process of writing it was so enjoyable that I got to the end of writing it. It felt like, if this is it, I kind of at least partly got what I needed out of it, which is, I was just in a really, really bad place. And I felt like it's that sort of opposite thing where I finally sat down to write something just to enjoy the process of writing, to actually have the process of writing be something that was fulfilling and an end in and of itself. And then that actually became the thing that was made. But I just felt like I was at a point where I was feeling like everything feels like a chore. It feels like work. And I need to get back to doing something that I enjoy. So the impetus for the script was, what would I just enjoy writing? Not even what's a feasible movie. Because, you know, I don't know. R-rated eighth grade film doesn't sound like a slam dunk, you know?
No, there's no superheroes. There's no explosions. And that's kind of what, that was the next question, was that you just said something that's, it's interesting for writers to hear. Most of these people are writers. They want to know about your process. You sat down to write something that was going to make you happy and that you would enjoy writing. not an assignment or I'm going to try to do the next superhero. I'm trying to do the next Wonder Woman. You sat down and wrote something for yourself. So that's a very liberating thing for writers to hear. Maybe you can talk about your process a bit about once that happened, what your process was.
Yeah. And truthfully, I wish I could at any point conjure the ability to just sit down and write something I enjoy. It's I have long, long dry spells between the inspiration that then gets me to a place where I'm, you know, writing very fervently and feeling very excited. But yeah, I mean, it really was. I mean, I think this might be partly an answer. Part of my process is I just can't really I have to sort of just jump in and just start writing people talking to each other or write a scene. It has to sort of prove to me that the heart is beating right away before I even try to structure it. And it might not even be like and I don't even think that's a tactical decision. I think it's just because I need to prove that I enjoy doing this, that like writing this thing, writing these people feel alive and it feels enjoyable to me. Because I think of myself as a writer. I mean, first, second, and third, like, and it's actually what I get the most enjoyment out of. So my barometer for the core of what I work on is how does it make me feel when I write it? I mean, that's more than like, what does it sound like or what do people think when they read it? It really is. The thing I'm pursuing is just because, you know, I haven't worked that long, but I've just found that the things that I enjoy writing the most are the things that have the best chance of connecting with people. And it's, I feel like I can tell that when I watch someone else's work or read someone else's work. That if there's just a sort of passion and joy in the writing itself, it's just like totally infectious. And you can fail with either way. So you might as well, you know, like what's the point of other than, you know, making money, which, you know, it's definitely not easy to like passionately make money. I haven't figured that out yet, but yeah.
You can mechanically make money and be passionate about it.
So. Yeah. Yeah. You can be passionate about the money. Yeah.
So you started with the characters' voices. Your entry into eighth grade was finding the character voices. Is that how you created the characters? You would put them in situations and just have them start talking like Elsie's. Kayla's Elsie's incredible, incidentally. They all are. Performances are absolutely totally believable, as if you're shooting a documentary.
Honestly, I appreciate that. Well, that was again, the writing was written to hopefully be that messy and that natural. The decision to direct it was only to deliver on the writing. I always feel like that as a director, I'm just directing it because I want the writing to be delivered correctly. But really in creating Kayla, it was like her isolated voice that was the first thing to be captured. So the first thing I wrote was just monologues of her just with a topic in her head, just talking about herself. Because when I would watch videos on YouTube of young kids speaking to camera, like I'm speaking right now, the way in which they spoke was it existed in such sharp contrast to the way I saw kids speaking in movies, and not only kids speaking in movies, but kids speaking in movies on webcams looking to camera, like identical scenes in movies had kids that were perfectly articulate. They're little like poet laureates that are, you know, looking right to camera and saying, okay, so I'm going to tell you the story about how I went from being the queen of the school to the bada bada. And then once in this, and it's all poppy and snappy and performative and presentable. And when I would watch these kids online speaking, the layers of their speech and the performance of their speech, which is just the reality of one being a human being, but especially being a kid, which is like, I have an idea of what I want to sound like. I have a process of delivering what I want to sound like. I have my own reaction to the way I'm sounding. I'm adjusting myself in front of this unseen mirror that you can't see, which is I see myself as I'm talking. It's very, very complex to me. And as I was watching these kids stumble through a video, just talking about how to be cool, I was like, this is what it means to be alive right now to me. This weird rhetorical performative game that these kids are doing feels so true to me. And so that was the initial writing, was just writing that opening monologue of her being herself, which is like, being yourself sounds so, it's so trite, but it's also like, be yourself. I mean, that's as, you know, to be or not to be, or I mean, that's like all these sort of stupid little like cliches and bromides of, you know, that kids latch onto in these videos are actually, I think, very deep. But anyway, I'm getting way off track.
No, it's very telling. This is
the point is I at least in with eighth grade, for sure, what I was trying to do was capture a way of speaking, a failure of speech. And that's especially with kids. And that's the mistake that for me that movies about young people often make mistakes with. And it's a cross production. It's, you know, you're portraying, how do you, you're writing people that don't yet know how to speak. You're dressing people that don't know how to dress themselves. I think probably the human experience is, but certainly childhood is just failure. Everything is a failure. And even your thoughts are even a failure to yourself in your own mind. You're even doing a performance to yourself and whatever.
There's a wonderful moment, and we talk a lot about how we build character. That's kind of my method and process to take some of the mystery out of this for writers. And one of the things we always ask is, what does my character want? What does my character need? What are the differences? And you do a brilliant thing with Elsie, and she's so good in the scene. She's actually sitting down and writing what she wants.
Yeah.
She says it right there in blue and white.
Yeah.
And over here, how to get it.
Yeah, exactly. So,
it's perfect to be, and she is smiling as she's writing this. She's actually happy.
Yeah. Well, that was the funny thing about part of this is that I realized that, and especially if you're writing a film that takes place now, people are aware of movies, and not even that, people try to conjure movies into their own life. You know, so I was getting to the point in the script where I was going, all right, well, this is the point where we need to know her goals and we need to know how she's going to get them. And I'm going, well, she could just literally do it. Like it's almost an inside joke for writers of that point in the story. It's, you know, the beginning of the second act or whatever. She's actually like, she's got a plan she's moving forward and she's writing the stuff down. But I mean, I think that stuff can be, I think it's interesting to maybe think about the fact that you don't have to be the only one aware of plot. I mean, you can see plot as something that your characters are also aware of, you know, that your characters are desperate to structure their own arcs, and it might not be in perfect union. It shouldn't be with what you're ultimately going to tell in your story, but to be aware of, I mean, a lot of the writing that works for me, and again, I've written, you know, one script that's got made, I don't really know anything, but when it works best for me, it feels like listening. And the sort of the big turns in my script that felt like turns were actually me just jumping into a scene, writing it, and doing the thing where it's almost like you're playing chess with yourself and you're going from one side to the other if you're writing dialogue or doing stuff between it. And you really are, every time you walk to that other side of the table, trying to beat the other person, honestly. It really, for me, it's just about listening. The best form of writing to me feels like I'm listening to the characters and I'm meeting them and they're surprising me. Rather than I'm like going like, all right, what should they be and what would make them interesting? Because I've also fallen to that thing. And that's just like death. And then I get in my own head. But the best stuff, the best character stuff feels revealed. Because I certainly don't feel good enough of a writer to sit down and create human beings. You know what I mean? But I can maybe set up situations where I can just stumble into things where I'm, where they're talking to me a little bit, and I can start to hear them and understand them as I write them.
I have, this is great because there's only one plot in your movie. Everything else is character driven. And that the goal of what we try to do is to have character driven narrative as opposed to plot driven narrative. Mm. There's only one plot. It's the last week of eighth grade.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the why now. That's the why it's happening now to her. That's your plot.
Yeah. And it's like, it's, it, for me, it's like,
that simple.
Yeah. It's basically opening up the capsule and you, what the, what are you going to do with your life? Yeah. But that is the plot. The plot is, and I can, it's funny because it, some people, I definitely see a structure to the thing. I think there's like a total, like, inciting incident, turn, reversal, midpoint, low, all that stuff. But just, I guess it's a subjective structure. You know, the structure may not be seen by anyone but her in terms of the stakes. But if you're invested in the character, that was the hope of the film, was to go, you know, a normal kid's life to them feels like life and death every day. So can we take a pretty normal stretch of days in this girl's life where nothing, quote unquote, like spectacular or movie worthy happens to her, but portray it. But if we can somehow sync the audience's heart rate with hers and truly be subjective, like how can you make a movie that feels as dramatic as it does to her? Because that's the funny thing to think about, like Harry Potter and all these big fantastical kids movies, is that I think kids see them as like observational and relatable and not escapist, you know, that they really are. To a kid, walking and talking to your crush feels like slaying a dragon. So that's why kids gravitate towards fantasy, because their life feels that high stakes. And I think that's why we all do, but, yeah, I was just interested in making a...
Well, you've hit on my favorite subject, which is structure. I am a structure fascist and believe that structure is your friend, and it really captures lightning in a bottle instead of making you a formula. Your film is very carefully structured, and you use terms that are familiar to the audience. I use other terms, but you still got it. I was intrigued by the fact that you chose the, it was almost like curtain drops, like in a stage show where the phone blogs, her little video blogs, the punctuation marks, and you chose them very carefully to place, which dictated to me a structure that you had carefully thought out in your head, whether it was instinctive or you were conscious of what you were doing with those phone interviews. I'm just curious about the choice of that as a structure device.
Yeah, for me, I heavily lean on the first act into the second act structure. I think there's a little more freedom after that, but in terms of launching ourselves into the story with a newfound purpose going forward, which for Kayla, that moment is right after the karaoke scene, and she's confronted this thing that she was, you know, she's been this sad girl, opens her time capsule. We don't yet know what the inciting incident is because we find it out later, but we later know that looking at that, she realizes, like, what has my life become? I need to change it. She's given this opportunity to go to the pool party. She like rejects the call when her dad asks her, do you want to go to this thing or not? She finally does go to it. It's an initial failure and a setback that she then overcomes with a big forward, true commitment to it. Not a eye rolls to dad, I don't really want to go to this party, but really walking out and singing karaoke. It goes well enough for her to like fully commit to changing her life and trying something else. And like, it might not play as, you know, whiz bang plotty as other things, but like, I need to feel oriented by that. Cause structure and all that is just, I mean, just making it so it's not like soup in your hands. it just giving you some, it's just dramatic structure moment to moment so that you know where you are, you know what you know where you came from, you know where you're looking, and you just care about anything. Yeah, I mean, it's just helpful for me to know where I'm oriented. And well, that the audience, like you watch a movie where you go like, oh, the scenes could just be jumbled around and it would mean the same thing yeah.
No, your audience is the good work that you've done here is your audience is not aware of the structure because they're emotionally being pulled through this by Elsie's character, by Kayla. So, in terms of that, there's three things that you did that come in my protocol with what we do here. Cinderella moments. Your film is full of Cinderella moments where we give Elsie these little pats on the back and little hits of pixie dust and little moments where we're encouraged that she's going to make it. She's going to get there. Mm. And there's two or three of them that are just beautiful. And there is a moment in the very center of your narrative and good narrative has this moment. And it's what I call the top of the mountain. It's like, it's as good as it's going to get for her. Yeah. And when she gets that invitation to the mall from Olivia and she goes to the mall and she's suddenly part of a group,
yeah,
you know, and she's looking at what she's going to wear. I mean, that's Cinderella moment.
Yeah. Okay.
So you give your audience those kinds of moments and you have them in the third act too.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Really? Well, yeah, it's funny. It's like, it could sound like, and it's so funny because on the surface, it could sound like, oh, Cinderella moment is meant to be like sweet and, or too saccharine or too easy or like a fairy tale or whatever. But actually, like, if you're setting out to make the most depressing, like, bleak thing in the world, it is like imperative that you have those moments. Because it's like, if you want to break an audience's heart, you just show them the alternate reality when it can be okay. So like, I love that. I love that. And I really do love thinking about fairy tales and old stories. I mean, that really helps me too. When I just try to think about like how to write my story, it's like what Vonnegut used to do, you know, on the chalkboard with everything, like plotting out the stuff in a line. Like that's really helpful. As much as movies, I think about like, yeah, I'm like, what happened in Snow White? Or I go like, or wait, what happened even in like that story my mom told me when I was a kid? And it, like, you kind of want to get back to like the first, the core of how narrative interacts with you before you were like a conscious writer who was in their head too much.
Well, you invoke Vogler, and we both believe the same thing, that there are certain storytelling elements that are embedded in the universe. They're part of the ether of the universe that you can't fuck with. But they're always there, like your thing. What was that thing my mom told me? It's instinctive. You also invoke my other deity, Kurt Vonnegut, who I had the chance to work with before he died. Amazing. And I didn't realize when I started doing my charts that I went back and studied that I had been influenced by all of his charts.
Yeah, you know, they're amazing.
You really can find that where you're taking the audience. I have two last questions. How did you always know what the ending would be because you've chosen that frame with the time box and the phones, or did you have endings that you had tried to find and couldn't or didn't work?
We actually shot another ending. It's not really another ending. It's just another final shot instead of her walking down the street, which was her, like, we have it shot going into a dance and the like end of the year dance and dancing in the middle. And then like, a sort of surreal like spotlight hits her. It just felt a little cutesy and felt like it had been done. And I also felt like her triumph at the end is also lonely. And that was sort of important. It was interesting though. It was the thing I got in my head the most about was the ending. Cause I felt like, oh, does this need to be like, in order to be like art, does it need to be like way more ambiguous and way more dark and way more unresolved? And then I realized that, like, you know, this is her story and this is her. And it's the ending is not that it's going to be incredible. It's that she thinks it's going to maybe be okay. It's just staying in her experience. And like, what is the ending she would want to give herself? And not would want to, but what is the ending she is capable of giving herself? Which is that. So, Yeah, it's hard, you know, I felt like, I try not to be, it's hard to not be really, really precious about the opening and the ending and to think of them as so different than every other part of your movie.
Well, the phrase
rewritten multiple times, and actually the whole ending monologue, like her video, got re-recorded after the shoot, and it's like the easiest reshoot because she just comes over my house and we put a crappy background behind her and shoot her on my laptop. But
Were you informed? Because it's a beautiful ending and it's a very mature ending, and she's very honest. Her tone, even her face, is different. It's more mature and more settled and more serene and satisfied. I use the phrase satisfying ending, not happy, not sad, not good or bad, but satisfying. Have you taken your audience to a satisfying ending? And the fact that you shot it after the shoot, did the footage inform you? Did the performances inform you?
Yeah. You know, there was a version. It wasn't that different. The monologue was just, it kind of retained the unself-aware. And of course she's still a kid, so it's sort of unself-aware. But the thing that was added was the sense of and if you're not okay, that's okay too, because like, I hope high school's great for you, but it might also not be great. And it's okay because middle school wasn't great for me and I got through it. So you'll get through high school too, because before it was just about you'll get through high school and it's going to be, or high school's going to be great. You're going to, and I realized that like, she's been kicking this sort of like dishonest can of hope down the street the entire movie. And she's finally now, rather than, because it's kind of what got her into the mess in the first place, is that in sixth grade, she put all this pressure on her eighth grade self to be the best person ever. And now finally, it's ridiculous. I didn't realize this right in the script, but instead of just, you know, loading all of that stress onto her future self, she's actually forgiving her future self and saying like, you actually don't have to deliver on my behalf. I just hope you're all right. Yeah. And even if you're not all right, like, we're going to continue the struggle, the eternal human struggle to be all right or whatever.
It's an incredibly satisfying ending. It genuinely is. It was very moving for me today when I watched it last night.
It's a very funny thing. I'll say it very funny. This is just a mark of the movie. Sorry, the writing. But her initials are KLD for some. I mean, I don't know why I chose L. But I had multiple people come up to me after screenings because at the very end, she's in her backpack and the initials KLD are in the back. And they thought like it was code that she was killed right after.
Oh, no.
I was like, no.
That's the alternative ending on the DVD is, yes, she went.
Yeah.
There's the old bit. Real quickly, your stand-up. And I asked Jordan Peele the same thing last year. Our dear friend Robin Williams, who we spent great years with and miss him enormously, you're stand-up. So you're aware of the audience. You know, the audience is always a factor in your performance.
Yeah.
Did you take the audience with you when you were writing and when you were shooting? Did the audience have a presence with you at all in terms of that process?
A little bit, and not totally. I think the audience was most with me in the editing process, but I definitely do think, and if this is anyone that just has any background in the live arts or theater or any sense, like, I do think I'm lucky to have a part of me that just is fluent in the way an audience experiences something. Not that I was going to be able to perfectly translate it or perfectly know, but as I was making it and I was definitely editing and I think writing to a collective experience in a theater. I definitely wasn't thinking of people watching this alone. Hopefully it works like that as well. But I was thinking of, yeah, set pieces that would be experienced as a group. And I think even if you end up, if your thing ends up streaming or alone on a laptop, that's still a good invisible thing that your story should aspire to. Or, I mean, I actually hate speaking in the second person because I'm what do I know? But I'm just saying this to myself, like, that's what I like to, because when you think about one person watching it, you get in your head because you're like, who the fuck is this asshole, you know? But like when you think of a group of people, it really is like it's a cross section. It's what the audience actually is. So, but yeah. I mean, and it's also what I like to do. I like my stand-up shows were very theatrical and went for big reactions. And I always felt like I was trying to do sort of a magic show. And even this movie's going for that. You know, I wanted to make a movie where people would be cringing or covering their eyes or stuff, just because I think like, that's just fun for me. You know, I aspire to just be like the Blue Man Group. And that's my final, that's my real point. Just watch the Blue Man Group if you want to understand how to manipulate an audience.
My son was a Blue Man for 5 years in Boston.
Really? At the Charles Playhouse?
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's like the staple of Boston, the Boston cultural scene, which is.
And we watched it. I must have seen the show 100 times.
It's the best. When did he do it?
He's been writing with me now for about 10 years, about 10 years ago, 2008. 2007.
I mean, I probably saw him in high school. It's incredible.
Yeah, that's
awesome.
I'm going to ask you one last question, and then I'm asking you to stay with me when I say goodbye. Because I think a lot of people I know I asked it today, especially how moving her final sort of blessing is as she sends herself off into the future.
Yeah.
Is there going to be a freshman year?
Well, that's so funny. Well, freshman year's already passed for her. She's a sophomore now. You know, people asked if there was going to be a 12th grade. That'd probably be the thing. But, you know, part of it was like, part of the movie was going like, you know, kids have a lot of media and our culture is putting a lot of pressure on kids. And to have the success of that movie then put an incredible amount of media and cultural pressure on the actress to then immediately deliver her life as a movie all the time is too much for me. So I'm still in the process of like, just live your life, kid, and we'll chill out. And maybe down the road, if we want to make something again, we'll make it. But like, let's not get in a process of trying to just view our life as working towards the next film, especially when you're 15, because that's what the movie is trying to sort of rally against. But I would love to. I mean, she's great and she's amazing. But yeah, if there's like a 7 and Up or 7 Up or like a Boyhood version of it, I'd be happy
too. We just don't want to see her as an opioid victim or anything like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would probably be more interested in catching up with her at like 30 or something.
Yeah, that's it.
But the thing is, like, you know, obviously 12th grade would start with her digging up the capsule, which is like, you know, so that's where it feels like the right way to
go. I want to thank you. There's a lot of people that you can't hear right now that are applauding and saying,
Oh my God.
So, and hopefully we can get you to Austin for another visit.
Well, I appreciate the time, and I feel vastly unqualified. So take everything I say with a giant boulder of salt, and I don't know what I'm talking about, but I appreciate all of your time and attention. And thank you for the time.
Thank you, sir. Okay, we're signed off now, but I want to just go a couple of things. I will edit this video because what I try to do is use pieces of it as we talk about your film and the chart.
Got it.
I'll send it to you if you want to see it. I normally include it in the talk, you know, where I'm in pieces. Hey, guys. And then I do like to put it up on my website once the festival's taken place and all that stuff has gone on. And you're welcome to go look at the website and see that Jamie and Chazelle did it. Jordan Peele did it. There's a number have done it. So, I just want to make sure that's okay with you. If not, we'll restrict it to the.
Totally okay. You don't have to wait for my approval or anything. I mean, I don't, you know, I'm not.
Oh, this is a real treat. And I've got to tell you, I was really impressed with how seamless it's a really powerful structure. It really does. You have no idea. Because I teach structure and everybody's afraid of it. Not if it's character driven. And if your character pulls you and with your heart through the structure, they're not aware of it. It's the writers who push you.
I know. Well, it's just so funny because it's like you can just take the most apparently structureless character-driven esoteric stuff from that kids are obsessed with. It's like The Master or something. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, what are you talking about? Like, Freddy's in trouble. He's walking around. He has got nothing to do. He stumbles on this guy. He goes in there. I rely so, so religiously on structure. You know, it's like, it's the most helpful thing.
Well, I always tell people the best structuralist I ever met was Robin Williams.
Yeah.
It just came out of the blue in the ether.
Yes.
I would watch him after a performance and he would make notes and shift things around and say, do you think this worked? You know, and he could tell the joke about the history of golf with a drunk Scotsman.
Yes, yes.
You hear that joke 100 times.
Yes.
And it's the same punchline every time.
Yeah.
And it kills you. And that's you guys know structure.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly.
Telling a good joke, knowing when to land a line, you know, that's structure. So.
Yeah, setup, payoff, yeah.
I really appreciate this. I'm going to let you go. I'm thrilled to be able to have you be part of this. And hopefully when I do the chart, I'll show you the chart and you'll go, wow.
Amazing.
There's a Cinderella moment. There's the top of the mountain.
I would love that. And hopefully I can make that all. I'd love to see you at the festival. But I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Great pleasure.
I want to thank James and Bo for being guests on the show today. If you want to get links to anything they spoke about in this episode, please head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/109. And if you want to have James V. Hart guide you through structuring your film, your screenplay, and just helping you with not only character, but the emotional journey of your character using his remarkable system, the Hart Chart, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/HartChart. That's H-A-R-T, chart. I promise you, you will not be disappointed. It is an amazing masterclass, as well as a ton of other bonuses you'll get if you take the course. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.